This is episode 3 of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, and welcome to episode 3 of the Software Freedom Law Show. I'm Karen Sandler.
And I'm Bradley Kuhn. So you want to come clean, don't you?
I do.
Okay. So
I'm sorry, but we this time we're phoning it in.
Well, we're not really phoning it in. I mean, we've got the equipment set up. We've got the mic on the stand, which is actually a cardboard box that we found in Karen's office, and we've got the USB audio interface all plugged in and everything.
It's true. Normally, a lot of our podcast is phoned in.
That's the guest is phoning in.
Right.
So the guests are always phoning it in, but we're not about phoning it in literally.
Right.
We're talking about the figurative idea of phoning it in, a la Steve Martin on Saturday Night Live, you know, when you phone in the performance, right? Because we're...
Well, this is the week of... this is a holiday week.
For
the
a lot
end
of people,
year.
It is indeed. Yeah. And I think it's important for us to have something out there, but we unfortunately don't have time to give you a full show in our normal way. But we do have...
Well, what we have is a speech that Bradley gave at the Plone Conference, right?
Back in October, I gave a keynote at the Plone Conference on a specific issue that I've been working on. And so we're going to use that recording. So we're going to recycle material. We're going to redistribute.
But it's actually... I have to jump in here to say that I just listened to it before we recorded this, or actually this morning, and found it very informative.
Oh, good.
And a good introduction to network services issues.
Right. So it's a speech entitled "If Software as a Service is Only the Network Luddite Free," which I suppose is a little bit of a pretentious title, but it's basically an introduction to the issue of network services and how they relate to free software.
And without any further ado, here's the speech.
And I'm a hacker primarily. I started as a computer science student, and I became a developer for a while. And then I got into this whole licensing thing and the GPL and how it worked and what it did and what kind of policies and procedures you need to have a functioning community of developers who work together and share in the way that the GPL and other free software licenses make possible. My talk tonight is going to be primarily about a question of policy. One of the reasons hackers end up disliking lawyers is because they spend their entire careers, lawyers that is, focused on questions of policy, and they jump too often to rules and regulations and systems and procedures before they've stepped back and looked at the questions of policy. And in my experience of interacting with free software developers and hackers is that you guys understand better than most lawyers, except maybe the lawyers who work with me at the SFLC, how to think about these policies questions and how the free software community as a group and as a friendly, collaborative environment should respond to those policy questions. And once we understand those kinds of policy questions, that's when we walk towards legal issues like licenses and agreements and rules. But until the policy question has been looked at very carefully, it's very difficult to try to set up those rules. What I'm presenting tonight is a policy question that I think needs an incredible amount of attention, and I'm not even ready to start laying down legalistic ideas about how it should work. But before I do that, I'm going to spend about 10 minutes, and my whole talk's going to only be about 40 minutes, and there's going to be plenty of time for questions, about a historical context for how we got to the point we're at today in the free software world. And the first 5 minutes or so are going to be the talk I used to give in 40 minutes, so it will be a bit of a whirlwind tour. You know, in the beginning, there was free software. In fact, it just came with the computer that you got. This is an example of an early computer, the PDP-10. And it had terminals, and in the early days, there were teletypes like you see here. And eventually, they became TTYs as we know them today, which actually stands for teletype, but doesn't actually print anything out. It's just a screen. And eventually, it became the graphical display. And the users interacted directly with these terminals or these graphical displays, and the computer was somewhere close by, through the distance of a cable sometimes, but it was somewhere where you could get to it, and you actually knew where it existed, and you knew what software was on it because you could put it there yourself. And the initial state of computing was actually a state of freedom. And this is primarily because the computer manufacturers were wanted to sell you hardware, physical things that you would put in a machine room like this. And they didn't care so much about whether or not they got licensing fees or various other things for the software. So you had what we've often called the four freedoms of free software. You had the freedom to learn about the software because you could study its source code as you got it from the manufacturer. They didn't really care all that much in the 70s if you copied and shared software around for the computers. In fact, they kind of encouraged it because there weren't that many computer users. There weren't that many computers, in fact. So software sharing sort of increased the possibility of sales of the hardware anyway. Of course, since you had the source code, most of it was in assembler, maybe some Fortran, you could modify it and make new versions of the software. And of course, you could share those improvements with other people in this relatively small community of software users. Then came the 80s, and that's when we started to get the idea of a software license. This thing, this legal instrument of policy that was designed to separate the computer from the software you got from it. Now, it's true that most people get their software with their computer, but it's not coming from the same place. This was an invention. Somebody thought up the idea of licensing software rather than giving it to you with full freedom with your computer. And the question is out there about who invented it. No one actually knows, but there's some theory that it was this guy. He wrote in the late 70s, early 80s, a letter to hobbyists, which I've translated into law code here for everyone, that suggested the idea that sharing your software was wrong, that you were somehow hurting somebody by sharing your software. Most of us in the free software community don't believe that. That's why we use software under the GPL and other free software licenses. We know, and I've met many people here, that do commerce and make money around that kind of free software like Plone. But there was a theory put forward by a rather wealthy individual now, although not when he had this picture taken, who thought this was a good idea, and he convinced the largest hardware manufacturer in the world that it would be better if he contained control of that software and only licensed it rather than making it part and parcel to getting the computer. Now, this problem had to be fixed. And in fact, the history of the free software movement, which I usually spend a much more long time talking about, but we don't have to anymore because we most of us know it, this problem got fixed by a lot of people. But there's probably one person that deserves a large bulk of the credit, at least in my mind, and that's this guy, my old boss. And here he is blessing a computer, but this is purely symbolic of what he did for many, many years, because he was in that old environment. He actually lived through the era of the PDP-10. In fact, that was the first computer he worked on when he got a job at MIT. And he really understands these issues much better than anybody realizes. He's a very hard guy to work for, which is why I don't work for him anymore. But he's a philosopher and understands these issues because he lived through a golden age of computing, which we've just, in the past few years really, reached again. It was an age of academic computing where you could share your software and there weren't licenses that restricted you from it. Now, we have licenses today that RMS is in some ways responsible for inventing many of that insist upon this type of software sharing. So we've analyzed the policy question and said, what we should actually have, if there is going to be such a thing as a software license, because it's an inevitability under the existing legal copyright system, we should have licenses that respect freedom. Unfortunately, we had to go back and reinvent all this because throughout the 80s, MIT changed, and here's a picture of a strange thing they did. The building here is this building right there is the old AI lab where Stallman used to work. They constructed a building in between it and then tore this one down. I've never understood why they did that over the past 6 or 7 years. But what MIT discovered as they were tearing down the old AI lab was that you could make a lot of money if you patented software and copyrighted software, and that if you made spin-off proprietary software companies, the worst of which probably being RSA Incorporated, you could somehow control users of software. And instead of the invention of software happening from an academic environment and being put out there for the public good, which I think is a good argument to be made that most academic computing should be doing that. Instead, they designed it to primarily bring revenue to the university. Fortunately, inside the same doors of MIT, Stallman was doing the GNU project, which in fact changed our world and made possible what's happening with things like Plone today because of the GPL. However, it only solved the problem for individual computer users. It solved the problem of the teletype or the display with a computer that you were connected to, perhaps with a few wires. And in fact, we've solved that problem, fortunately, because right now you can run on your computer, as I am today, a fully free operating system with a full suite of free applications and services and exciting stuff that you can do all under various free software licenses. And computer networking, which was introduced in mass in the late 90s, didn't actually screw this idea up too much. It still worked pretty well in the standard internet model to have free software and still have freedom with your use of computers. Because when you set up a client-server environment in the traditional 1990s sense, you have basically the same implications of freedom and rights of users and whether they get the freedom to copy and share and modify and distribute the software as you did in the single computer model. And I'm going to walk through an example of how it's basically the same as having freedom on your own computer by talking about how email works, which is a problem we all know pretty well, modulo the spam issue, and we could talk about it sort of how does the freedom issue of your right to use and copy and share the software get affected. Well, let's talk about first the mail transport agent, the mail server that sits in some server farm or on somewhere that it processes your email. Well, most of us probably use servers that have free mail server programs, as in freedom sense. You know, there's these various examples. I prefer Postfix, rather. A lot of my friends like XM. I've used SendMail enough in my life that I never want to use it again, but it was free software nonetheless. And there's proprietary mail servers out there. I suppose that Microsoft has mostly taken over the proprietary mail server market. And we had this fortunate thing in the early age of the internet that there were protocols for everything, and it was described exactly how things were supposed to interact with each other. And you had to obey the RFC, not because it was mandated to you, but it was a policy question, and you weren't participating in the community properly under the policy if you didn't obey the RFCs. Now, some people didn't some of the time, and Microsoft Exchange, as most people know, has certain types of undocumented protocols, but we've been able to reverse engineer them. The Open Change project is doing that for Exchange right now. And that's actually an offshoot of a much better, or much more developed, not necessarily better, project called Samba that reverse engineered the CIFS protocol that was proprietary from Microsoft. So we know how to handle this when your server doesn't have freedom problem. How do you turn it into a free server? So we've got that solved. So let's look at the client side. You have your mail user agent, the thing you use as a mail client, and you can select from a variety of different ones. Thunderbird even runs on Windows if you're still stuck in a proprietary operating system. I use Mutt and GNUs, and there's every host of type of mail client. Everybody writes a mail client at some point in their life, right? So there's also the proprietary ones, but you have the choice, and people just implement the features of the proprietary ones into the free clients, and everything's pretty good. We have freedom on the server side, we have freedom on the client side. But something's changing right now in our industry, this post-Web 2.0 thing. The browser has become the platform of choice for delivering applications, and most of you in the room probably work in your daily lives thinking about the browser as your application delivery platform. I think this became solidified when Ajax got to the point where it was solid and able to work. And you could actually have a web page that didn't have to do a post every time you wanted to do something, and you could connect back to the server in some sort of asynchronous way. But it opened a very complicated question. The question of where is a individual user's computing done? In the client-server model, it's relatively straightforward what's going on. When you're using your mail user agent on your own computer, you're doing your own computing against your own data on your own hard drive. When you ship an email off to the server in the client-server model, the server's doing work, and it's no longer really your computing anymore, because what you're doing is asking a server to send it on. Now, if you're in control of that server, you have a myriad of free software services to install there. So each person in control of each individual server and each individual client has a choice of what they want to have happen with regards to their own freedom. In this new model, the model of so-called cloud computing, that choice is not so clear anymore. You have a free software browser, but you have all of your applications living in the cloud. And what you actually need as a user experience is being controlled by that. And it's very similar to the problem we faced in proprietary operating systems, but substantially more complicated in its implications. So I want to look a little bit at what has happened and why the cloud computing raises all sorts of new questions. When you think about what Gmail is, it's based around a user experience. It's the client and the server at the same time. Everything's being delivered to your browser. And effectively, your computer that once was a computer that could do lots of things and do your own computing for yourself has really just become this thin client that connects to the cloud and gets whatever things it needs, including the applications and the data. And we're back to this moment where we're confusing free as in price and free as in freedom. People say Google Apps is free. Well, yes, it's free as in price. Is it free as in freedom? Well, let's go back to the old definition. Source code-wise, it's not, because you can't have the source code and the freedom to copy, share, modify, and distribute. But even that is a problem. That's not the only problem, rather, because your data is being controlled by Google. They're indexing it to show you ads. And that's, of course, how they're giving you the no-price service, is that they're showing you advertising, which is tuned to the data you happen to be reading in your email. But worse than that, it's not a question of mere protocols anymore, because you're participating in a community of Gmail users, which, if someone else is using Gmail, it's a little bit better and easier to communicate with them. So if you wanted to leave Gmail, well, sure, you can download all your email folders, you can download your address book, but you've now left the Gmail community behind. And this gets even worse when you talk about things like Google Apps and Google Spreadsheets and Twitter, for example, where if you don't want to be on Twitter and you want to microblog from your own site, well, you don't have the ability to follow the people you were following before because they're still on Twitter. So you can't actually move your community. So the fact that the protocols are open is not enough. And we're back to the world of you are locked into a specific service provider, and leaving it is very difficult, which is exactly the fear that led us to invent free software in the first place. So this is my model of what the cloud ends up being in my mind. When they started saying cloud computing about 6 months ago, it became a buzzword just overnight, like they do. And I won't say what product this is a commercial for, but this was the first thing that came into my mind when somebody said the computing in the cloud. Because what's really happening is you're stuck down at the bottom with Firefox while all your real applications actually live up there in this cloud that you can't reach up to or dissipate or do anything with. You just hope that Firefox can get you there most of the time and get your work done. So meanwhile, my old boss is still out there doing his work, and I'm very respectful of it. But he said something that a lot of people thought was not that helpful recently, and this is the quote, which I won't read out so it won't be clipped out to have me saying it. But I actually, you know, a lot of my friends who are thinking about these policy issues of cloud computing were rather upset that he said this because it's dismissive, and we're trying to find a way to do cloud computing in a free way because we think it is something worth doing. We just have to figure it out. But I take it as a challenge. You know, Stallman processes his world through Emacs on his own computer, and he is, in all definitions, a true network Luddite. He didn't use the web for many years. So I think that he will not be affected by cloud computing, at least personally, in the way that he was when the whole world changed and MIT stopped having a free software environment. That affected him directly as a programmer working for MIT. He's not going to be affected by cloud computing, I can assure you. Stallman will never have his freedom taken away by cloud computing. But I use search every day, I admit it. Proprietary Google search. That's the only way I know how to search the internet well. And I think we're being challenged with that same challenge that faced Stallman. Actually, it's a little bit harder now to say, what does a free network cloud look like? Free as in freedom. And I want to respond to that challenge. And it's not merely a question this time of code and licensing. I first was introduced to this problem in 2001 when Henry Poole raised it to the Free Software Foundation, and I invented the idea of what's called the Afero GPL. I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. And I thought, well, okay, we have a license. Now we just need some coders to write some network service code and license it under the AGPL, and it solves the problem. Well, it actually doesn't. It solves a piece of the problem, and I spent about 5 years ignoring this problem again because I thought I'd solved it already. But the fundamental question is not just the source code, but the control of data and how the community controls their own data. And their ability to take the application, the data, and the human connections among people that they've built through that service somewhere else when they want to. And I think Twitter is the best example of how this problem comes up. It's hard to leave Twitter. I left Twitter because in a minute I'm going to talk about a service, a microblogging service that is free in this way. But I didn't get to take the people who followed me. My last Twitter was, I'm leaving Twitter and here's where I'm going, and I hoped that people would follow me. But most of them didn't. My wife didn't. My wife's still on Twitter. So I don't see her updates. And she doesn't see mine, as it turns out. Well, actually, she sees mine because she subscribes to him through RSS because I turn out to be on a free software. This is a question, ultimately, of autonomous communities being able to create their own world of software, data, and community. So I think we're very early in this process. And so I am not really trying to put forward solutions of how we're going to solve this. I think these are questions that we have to start answering. But it's clear to me that you guys have already started, because what you've built is Plohm, which is an infrastructure, because of its licensing under the GPL, that respects people's freedom. And you have the ability with Plohm to empower users by giving them the code to their applications and giving them their data, because you have the ability to modify Plohm and make it do these things and respect users' freedom. And it's important, though, that we don't just stop with the licensing of the code. We have to make sure that when we build applications, that the community of users can transplant themselves when they want to and go somewhere else. It's just like the free software issue where you tell people, well, you don't want to go with a proprietary vendor because you'll be locked in. Whereas if you go with me, I'm a vendor around the GPL, you can hire anybody you want, I hope you'll stay with me, but you're not locked in. It's the same thing with a network service. You're going to have a better network service business if you're telling people they can go somewhere else if they want to. Because people deserve the right to reclaim their data and rebuild their community. Now, in a lot of cases, this is very tough. The Twitter service that I talked about, it doesn't actually have all these features yet, because building truly distributed computing networks that allow for services to replant themselves and connect back up to the old service in some sort of sane way is really, really difficult design task. There are people who do PhD theses about distributed computing and how to connect various different nodes that may or may not be there up. We have to start reading those theses. We really have to start understanding true distributed computing to be able to get to the next step. So I have a couple of projects I encourage you to go and look at that I think are working towards getting some of these questions right. At least they're asking the questions as they develop. Evan, who's a group of this thing within the group of this thing called Autonomous that I'm going to mention at the end, he launched a site called Identica, which is a Twitter replacement, a microblogging service. And the software system he built is called Laconica. And he's actually trying to solve this in that particular space of microblogging. A guy named Jesse Vincent wrote a system called Prophet, which is a distributed database for web applications. Now, you guys aren't, truth is, you guys aren't going to be able to use it. It's written in Perl, which means we all hate it because it's not in Python. But look at his ideas. Look at what he's doing and see if we can do the same thing in the Python world. He's got the idea of, hey, your web database, your web data store, should be completely portable all the way down to Sneakernet, which my immediate thought when he said that was, well, this is perfect in a place like China, where, as we heard during the Olympics, there's all sorts of network editing and blocking and not allowing people freedom on the internet. Imagine trying to run a free web service in China where your user base might disappear or you might have to disappear. If you can carry away the entire web data store in a USB key and bring it back up somewhere else and all the connections come back right, it's a really important feature for someone running a Chinese community on the internet to have. And it would work pretty well here too. And I think that what you're doing in Plone is good, and it will make it easier for developers to respect freedom when they get freedom in the software they're distributed. And I'm glad that you guys are continuing to do that. And I'm not, by the way, trying to convince you to switch licenses. The Affera GPL is worth looking at because what it does is adds as a policy matter that license clause to make sure that people using the software as a network service get the freedoms to copy, share, modify, and redistribute the software. However, there's nothing preventing you under GPL from giving people all the source code to the system you've built with Plone if you want to. You're allowed to do that under GPL, it's just not mandatory. So it's really a BSD versus GPL question. Sort of the Affera GPL, the GPL is the BSD of the Affera. Right, so you can still do what gives people source code, and there's lots of great BSD code that stays free software because the community pushes for it and makes it happen. You can do the same thing in the GPL space. So I'm not here to make a pitch to switch Plone to Affera. What I'm saying is think about what AGPL is trying to do to handle the issue of giving to the user base and see if maybe Plone could do that just under the GPL because it wants to. And I hope you'll look at ways to deploy applications so that users can automatically get the source. You know, imagine if when you install Plone, it automatically has a link to the source code that's running on the server. And every time you add a module or anything else, it automatically goes into there. It wouldn't be a bad default, I think. So certainly, people will be allowed to turn it off because they can modify it if they want. But what if the community default became you always give your stuff back to all your user base as far as source code goes? And the other thing is when you build web applications, think about making communities that can transplant themselves to another service and to another provider if they want to. Don't force them to lock in, just like you wouldn't force them to lock into you as under the GPL because the GPL doesn't permit that. Don't try to do it on the data side either. I implore you, at least. What I think the real future of cloud computing is to have people operating disjointly but still able to communicate and collaborate with people on the net. To have a certain amount of autonomy while being portable around the net to find other people that they're supposed to be connected with rather than having it all centralized into one server. And I think that people who develop the software are going to decide this. I was talking about this BSD versus GPL thing and then GPL to AGPL question. It's really up to developers if they want to make these kinds of communities, they can demand it because they can design the code so that's the default way that things work. And when you're doing one of these cloud computing projects, just ask yourself if you're respecting the freedom of the users and their autonomy to go somewhere else if they want to and get their data out of the system and so forth. Ultimately, the data belongs to the user. And we as developers of cloud computing infrastructure are the custodians of their data, and we should be good custodians, treating the users well in this regard. You can look at this website called Autonomous, which has more info about, it's basically a think tank, loosely organized group that's thinking about these issues. And as I said, I don't think I have answers of how this stuff should be. I'm just suggesting that we start thinking about these questions in a much more deep way. We're sort of at that 1983 point in free software's evolution for cloud computing. We've got to start asking these questions of what does freedom mean in the cloud?
Are you still here? Anyone? I guess we just wanted to thank you for listening to the entire speech and making it to the end.
Yes, indeed. I'm glad that people were kind enough to listen to me drone on for so long.
Well, as I said in the introduction, I had no problem listening to the whole thing.
Okay.
I found it to be quite interesting, and hopefully you all did too.
Yep. So we'll be back in 2 weeks with our normal format, and you won't have to listen to me for the entire hour like you did today.
Well, you'll have to listen to him a little.
Yeah, I'll still be on the show. I'm not going to resign as host or anything. I plan to come back as host for the next
year. We'll both see you next time.
Yes, we'll both be here, and it won't just be a speech from me that we recycled from October.
All right, bye. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States License.